they are more nodes in a financial and commercial global network than they are designed to govern over a community and make that community the best place for its residents to live.
You're listening to Damn the Absolute, a podcast about our relationship to ideas, produced by Eradicus. Here's your host, Jeffrey Howard.
Welcome, friends, philosophers, and fellow practitioners of ideas. This is episode 15 of Damn the Absolute. When it comes to resource management, there are two dominant forces that exert tremendous influence on who gets what: the market and the state. Sometimes these two entities compete or conflict. Other times they collaborate and even conspire to the great detriment of communities. Either can result in environmental exploitation, extreme inequality or poverty, erasure of culture and place, and invite an alienation that is generated by people having limited say in what happens in their communities. Yet there remains a resource management system whose history runs deeper than either the market or the state, and that is the commons. Distinguished by its clearly demarcated membership, it is fiercely democratic and practices a more locally oriented governance regime. A given resource is apportioned and stewarded by members according to norms they determine within their community. For the most part, neither the market nor the state are expected or even encouraged to intervene. One is either a contributing member of the commons or they are not. But if commons have such a rich heritage, then why have they become less prevalent in the United States and in what are considered developed countries? Neil Gorenflot is the executive director of Shareable, an award-winning nonprofit news outlet, action network, and consultancy focused on the latest innovations in resource sharing, the commons, and the solidarity economy. He is also the author of Sharing Cities, Activating the Urban Commons. In addition to the state and the market, he proposes the commons as a way to foster small-scale experiments to see what works best in any given community. This pragmatic approach to solutions is geared toward addressing needs more than trying to satisfy any particular ideology. As the saying goes, ideologies divide us, while needs unify us. Now, looking further into the 21st century, what would it take for the commons to become a prevailing paradigm for resource management? What does a sharing cities approach to urban development look like? And what prevents a commons from being co-opted or captured by the market or the state? I hope you'll contribute to the conversation. Well, Neil, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks, Jeffrey. I mean, I love the theme and name of the podcast, Damn the Absolute. It sounds like a kind of battle cry.
Yeah, hopefully it's not as iconoclastic or combative as it sounds, but we do have a skepticism toward absolute-minded things, so welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I can relate.
And in that spirit of Damn the Absolute, we put great value around the practice of intellectual humility. What is a viewpoint you've held in adulthood you were certain would never change, has actually shifted dramatically?
Yeah, I share that. I share that spirit of intellectual humility because I have a lot of experience in being humbled by experience and by life. I'll give one example. I might share another too. But, you know, I grew up in a conservative family and a military family. I also had, by nature, a kind of anti-authoritarian streak. So the idea that government should play a sort of minor role in society, that I leaned toward that early in life. I moved out of that limited frame of big versus small government, mm-hmm. and realized that it's not the size of the government that matters. It's the scope and depth of our participation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if government is smaller or larger because we all play an active role, then it's all for the better. Mm-hmm. And conversely, if we don't believe or participate in government, then government will deteriorate. And that becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. And then, you know, just as a contrast to that, later on in life, much later, I'd say much more recently, like around the time I started thinking about shareable and sharing. And I had this idea that setting up parallel local democratic political economies was a viable strategy for systemic change. But now I realize that this is only half the formula, that there's no parallel human universe that's possible. We live in one human world. There may be many worlds within it, but it's still one human world. And, you know, it's a contest between systems. So I came to favor more a dual power strategy where you build the local world you want, and you also carve out room in the larger society for it so it can exist and grow and maybe even scale to the level of being the dominant mode. So in other words, you build and fight. And this is newer, also a newer realization is that I see this as a kind of multifaceted enterprise, not just dealing with politics and economy, but all things that shape our time, physical space, attention, behavior, beliefs, relationships, and consciousness in society. You know, I think in the mistake I made when I was younger is thinking about one avenue or one niche to make this happen, to make change happen. There's so many people who play in a niche. We do too at Shareable. We talk about sharing, but it's not enough. I don't think it's enough. I think we must fully enact the worlds that we want to live in, the world that we want, though we do need starting places at the same time.
There's a spirit of democracy that shines through in some of what you're talking about and some of your work. In what ways does your view of democracy contrast with other prevailing notions or more common notions of democracy that people talk to you about?
Yeah, I think that the popular tendency, at least my opinion, is that politics and democracy is like the separate sphere. It's something you do occasionally, and it's another world where you play a small part, unless you're a politician or you're in government. And my view is that democracy it's kind of a Walt Whitman view. It's everywhere. It's leaves of grass, right? And Ellen Ostrom might think of it as like, or might characterize it as democracy with a small d. She said that anytime people get together to make decisions, that's democracy. But it's not small d because it's insignificant. On the contrary, it's small d because it's everywhere. And it's also foundational. It builds those skills, those habits of mind, those norms that make big democracy, democracy with a big D, possible. I just see it as really important, an overlooked aspect of democracy, and kind of also recalls de Tocquevillian sort of observations of American democracy back in the 19th century, where it was very much a grassroots sort of New England town hall, part of everyday life experience.
You mentioned the Nobel Prize winning economist, Eleanor Ostrom. Her work has been really impactful in what you do at Shareable and has informed how you view sharing cities. Could you give us a bit of history about the commons and even tell us what is a commons?
Yeah, sure. Well, let's start with that. I mean, I draw on the work of David Boyer. He wrote this great book called How to Think Like a Commoner. And a commons is a democratically managed resource. It could be a forest. It could be grazing land. It could be software. It could be a business. And commons typically have three components, three main parts, right? First, you have that resource. You have the users. And usually in a commons, there's a very defined user group. You're either in or out. And then the third and the most important thing is the governance system. How decisions are made among users of that resource to manage, to care for, manage that resource, also create it to start out with, right? And then on the history of the commons, well, we could have a series of podcasts on that one. I mean, that's a big book.
Yes, it is.
But I would say commons have been around since time immemorial. Farming communities are generally traditional farming communities are run often as commons, where it's communal land and labor practices to make the products, to grow the produce. And also, some of the oldest commons are water commons, so irrigation, sharing water, basically, among a farming community, right? So super old. But also, there's a kind of, I'll skip ahead now, centuries or millennia, but there's also a kind of commons renaissance now. While at the same time, around 2 billion people rely on some form of commons still today. So that's like a fourth around of the human population that still depends on commons to make their lives work, to provision their lives. So it's not well enough understood and recognized and appreciated form of managing resources. And what Ostrom, what her work demonstrated, like the key idea, I would say, was systematically documenting and proving through case studies over decades around the world that commons management of resources is as good, if not better, than government management or private management of resources. That's the, I think, the basis of her Nobel Prize win. And it, and it's a, and it's like a stick in the eye of capitalism in a way. It's like, no, you guys, there's not only just one way, you know, the old sort of neoliberal phrase, there is no alternative. In the commons world, it's, there are many alternatives.
Coincidentally, or maybe ironically, my exposure to Eleanor Ostrom's work has actually been an interaction with either classically liberal or more neoliberal or Austrian economists, which is neither here nor there, but it's fascinating that that's where she comes from for me. I think for a lot of people, when they think of the commons, that exposure comes in the concept of the tragedy of the commons, which is often taught in an economics intro course in college or high school. And it's often used to then justify state interventions or free market oriented arguments for private property. Why might that be an incomplete picture or maybe an inaccurate telling of the tragedy of the commons?
Yeah, so Garrett Hardin's essay, The Tragedy of the Commons, is one of the most influential social science or economic or political economy articles of all time. And it's wrong. It's just the basis of it is, and I say that because the premise is just, the premise is off. What he describes is not a commons because there's no governance scheme. We talked about the three things. You have users and a resource, and then you have a governance system. Well, what Hardin describes in his essay isn't a commons. So it gets off on the wrong foot from the beginning. And so it's just wrong. Hardin, what a character. He knows, like, academic, but also with a huge ideological, on a huge ideological mission, in my opinion. He was torpedoing what he saw as absolute enemy. And he did a great job at it. Unfortunately for all of us.
What year was he writing this work about the tragedy of the commons?
I think it was 69. I would have to check.
Okay.
But I think it was 1969.
For those who are not as familiar, who somehow ditched out on their Econ 101 course, what is a quick rundown of the tragedy of the commons?
Yeah, just that users of a commons, say Hardin uses a classic example of a grazing lands, right? And so if you own a flock or a herd, and if you follow only your self-interest, if everyone only follows their self-interest, everyone will want to put as many sheep or head of cattle on the grazing land as possible. But if everyone does that, then that will end the resource, and therefore everyone loses, right? But what a commons does is they put a governance scheme in there, and so everyone talks to each other, and they decide on the usage levels by each user, and they manage the resource with a long-term perspective in mind. And yeah, this just brings to mind example I know from my work with FAS Research and my friend Harold Katzmeier, who had been studying water commons in an African country. And what he was trying to help resolve was that there were corporate farmers and there were family farmers. And the corporate farmers wanted to pump, and put as much land into production as possible. And they would increase the efficiency of pumps and of irrigation, and that would just put more and more land under cultivation. And the family farmers, they were thinking long-term. They wanted to pass their farm on to their family members. Mm-hmm. And so they were really interested in a different strategy altogether. And these were just totally incompatible, these different mindsets.
I'm reminded of when I was younger, my grandfather was part of a rural community, and you talk about water rights. in a commons, there are these strong cultural norms that people abide by, and they would have certain days of the week. You could have the irrigation ditch open onto your property, and it only could be open for so long, and people would generally abide by it. But there were strong social ramifications for whoever decided to keep the gate open longer than they were supposed to. And that's very different than when there's a norm violation not in a commons, then you start to have to bring in from a state intervention, some type of legal intervention, maybe even law enforcement, depending on the nature of it. And I think that's just a really stark contrast in that mindset you're pointing out.
Yeah, and a small user community. I mean, there's strong social ties and a kind of, you can easily observe each other's behavior. You can't act covertly. People will see what you do. And Ostrom has, she in her research identified 8 common like design principles for successful commons. And one of them is graduated sanctions, that if you break the rules, there's X consequence. If you do it again, there's XY consequence. If you do it again, then you may be cut off from use of the commons. And these are community enforced, not enforced by officials or police or government.
You've highlighted how there's these 3 different spheres. We have the state, markets, the commons. And in your work, you talk about there needing to be a bit of a balance between the 3. What does that relationship, or what might it look like to have a balance between those 3? Because right now, although you've mentioned there's a bit of a renaissance of thinking like a commoner, it's still not the most common way of doing things, at least from what I've seen in the United States. So what does that balance between the 3 look like?
That's a great question. And I'll start on it just by saying that the commons is sort of the people's ace in the hole, right? When the market and the state aren't really working, we have each other. And there's tremendous white space, to use a kind of strategy term. There are many things that we can do to help each other meet our needs and provision our lives that don't require any permission, any funding whatsoever. And so our position at Shareable is we should take up that white space. That's the starting place, right? Not wait around for help, not look for a savior, except ourselves, at least to start. And then going back to this idea of a build and fight is, after you've taken up that white space, it's vulnerable. Those institutions that you may have started, the cooperatives or the time bank, the lending library, the housing co-op, they might be vulnerable to new government regulation or sort of unfriendly private actors. So you have to establish a regime that protects those institutions so that they can persist and grow. And then thinking at just the larger term, like how all those 3 things work. First, to be honest, I mean, I wrote about it in Sharing Cities, and I'm not sure that this kind of heterodox economy where the 3 spheres are working together is possible if we have the kind of theoretical will and tools to make that happen, at least now. But thinking of it in the ideal sense, I don't think that they're competitive. I think that they can work together quite well. And you see some instances of this, for instance, in the open source software, where big corporations fund open source software projects. They benefit from it. And then those tools are publicly available and anyone can use them or contribute to them. There's a kind of symbiotic relationship. Similarly, when you have a strong sort of civil sector or common sector, then government can be more effective, that they can execute their programs. A lot of the climate change and social impact initiatives that local governments need to make happen are reliant on the public cooperating and being mobilized or mobilizing to make them happen. So that's an example of where there can be cooperation there. We already know that government and business can work together.
Unfortunately, we do. You take thinking like a commoner, and you're very focused on urbanization and what that means in urban centers. What are the biggest challenges you see cities in the United States facing in the 21st century?
Yeah, nice and big question, Jeffrey. yeah, so many challenges, actually. But I I think one of the main ones is that cities, especially big global cities like London, San Francisco, New York, Hong Kong, Tokyo, Seoul, for example, they are more nodes in a financial and commercial global network than they are designed to govern over a community and make that community the best place for its residents to live.
Mm-hmm.
And help residents mobilize to create a great way of life where they live. Those networks and the cities that serve them, and you see it in the kind of discourse, New York City wanting to be a leader and a global leader in a financial and tech world to be competitive. There's such a language of competition between cities. There's a kind of also backwardness to that, because the way to be successful is not to compete, is to be as unique and differentiated as possible as a city. So build on your authentic differences. Instead of what you see is cities all trying to do and be the same thing. The challenge then is for cities to be something that serve its residents. Residents have to make a claim on the city and assert their rights and grow their rights so that cities are more sovereign, more self-governing, and serve the interests of the residents more so than that of global corporations. And I think that once cities are able to make this kind of democratic turn, they'll be able to address issues such as climate change, such as inequality. We'll have more citizen-based agendas, and citizens will work on those things that impact them and work for those things that they need. And you see that to a degree already, that cities are on the cutting edge of climate action, for instance. But I think they could be even more, a more engine of change. And this is part of our thinking around sharing cities.
Hello, friends. Jeffrey here. Please go ahead, take a quick moment to click that subscribe button and rate us. It really helps us to further grow the community around Damn the Absolute. Enjoy the rest of the episode. I want to lean into some of these issues you talk about and challenges that cities face. One of them for many cities is housing. What might a sharing cities approach to housing look like? What might a solution be?
Yeah, there'd be multiple facets, just like there's multiple facets to the housing system as we know. First, there would be different zoning and land use policies, and you would go towards a much more mixed use and also more apartment, multifamily arrangements. You would have some sort of local facility for financing. So maybe you have a public bank and that can help fund affordable housing. The way the city would manage land would have to be different. In the United States and also in other cities in Europe and elsewhere, cities own a lot of land and they treat it as a commodity, not a public good. And so they're looking for the highest bidder. They're going to sell it. They're cozy with developers. And it's no secret that developers often drive the politics of cities and towns. So that land gets used in a sort of free market way for profit instead of for public good. So the land that cities own is owned in trust for us, for its residents, right? It could be put in a land bank or a community land trust and dedicated to affordable housing. And then also the way real estate's developed would be different. It would be citizen-led and cooperative. So there are examples in Germany, all over the world. Co-housing is also another example of citizens that the housing is developed by the citizens themselves. And it's developed to be lived in, not sold. It's developed not to be a commodity, but to be something that has a lot of utility. And so therefore you make it can be more affordable, because you're not, all those things that make it more marketable become secondary or not important, right? And you go for the essence of what you need for housing and the size that you need, also the size of units and so forth. And so residents get what they want, and it can be more also more affordable, and they manage it into the future as well. So they just developed by citizens and then managed into the future for that. And some cases, and so the financing has to be lined up for that too, right? So banks have to understand this form of development, which they normally don't. In Germany, they have started to, that the Green Party has a relationship with, a bank there. And this bank understands citizen-led development and are willing to fund it. And so, and the loan is made to the group, not to individuals, right? And so what that enables you to do is include people who don't have access to credit to get to own a home, because the loan is in the group and there's enough people in the group that have good credit that they will be able to get the loan. So then you also get housing for people low income or bad credit. So those are some of the pieces of what a commons-based land management might look like in a city focused on housing. All those things I described exist now, but they don't exist all together in any one place. I'm drawing from examples all over the world. That's the opportunity. It's definitely feasible and pragmatic and possible. I think there's an awareness barrier and kind of how-to knowledge barrier to bring all those elements together.
Food is another major resource for management, food production that drives a lot of economic activity. And there seem to be a lot of problems with the way food is produced globally, but especially in the United States. What are some ways you think food systems need to change to embrace a more sharing cities approach?
Yeah, I mean, for starters, we need to be allowed to grow our food. So in some cases, you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to turn your front yard into a garden or your backyard into a garden. You're not allowed to share seeds. We ran this campaign with the Sustainable Economies Law Center about seed saving and sharing because we noticed a trend of public libraries including seed libraries in their collections, right? So they would take the old, what you would see often is you take those old card catalogs. I love those things, right? Of course, they're not used anymore because we use computers, but they are perfect vessel for a seed library, those old card catalogs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they would just do that and they would get seeds from the community. And what a practical thing. But there were started in Pennsylvania. So certain areas like cracked down on it. Like it was like a national security threat. I mean, it was silly. Like we're going to corrupt our seed supply. It creates a vulnerability and it was just nonsense, right? And so the Sustainable Economies Law Center, with our help, did this advocacy and educational campaign. The Law Center wrote some model policies that carved out space in the law for these small communal seed exchanges and libraries. So this is an example of carving this. You think that it's okay to share seeds, but you can't in some places. So you've got to carve this out and make it possible to do. So that's an example. Also, there's these things called relatively new, been around for more than a few years now, is cottage food laws. This is another thing that the Sustainable Economies Law Center worked on a lot, and we've reported on it. There's limits on what you can use your kitchen to produce and then sell, right? And so cottage food laws allow you to make stuff at home and sell it without all of those high barriers for food quality testing and safety, right? Where you have to use labs and make it in a commercial kitchen and all this stuff, right? And then have all the labeling requirements and so forth. So there's a category of like low risk foods that you can produce and then sell. So, well, I think the bottom line is like just democratizing food production across the board in all of these various ways. I just gave a few examples, but there's much more that you could go. There's also this huge challenge that small family farms and farmers, they're aging out. And so there's no replacement except for corporate accumulation. A lot of the farmers don't have a succession plan or family members that want to continue the enterprise. It's a very, very tough business. Farming, a lot of hard work, very risky too, and can be low margin. You don't have as much uptake in the next generation. So we risk losing that farmland to corporations and have even more corporate control over the food system. I'm part of this group called Rooted Northwest that I'm on the fringes, so to be clear, but they bought 240-acre farm and they're developing a co-housing and agricultural community on that land. And I think that's a really interesting kind of solution because it's not corporate. It's not relying on one family or even one individual. A community is the stakeholder and the caretakers of that land. And that seems to me to offer some financial, some risk and stability and democratizing the food system advantages. So I'd like to see more. I'd like to see more of that. I think that's also an option. And maybe there could be some, you know, sort of regulatory or tax supports for that kind of that way forward in farming.
At this point in history, I'm looking at the history of the commons, and commons used to be much more common and eventually got overtaken by market institutions, by state institutions, and now they're pretty small. What reasons do we have to hope that we can either turn the tide or resist that from happening, where there are places where we can have hope that commons are popping up? What gives us hope that those aren't going to be swallowed up again or co-opted?
There is always that risk, and you have to be vigilant against that. It depends on the will of the people. There is a kind of renaissance, a commons renaissance I speak of and that we write about at Shareable. But I would say it's somewhat nascent and starting to break into the mainstream, even in mainstream politics in some cases, for instance, with Jeremy Corbyn in the UK. And I think the best route to see this kind of evolve and grow is to like establish commons at a local level, get municipal support and even private support for those commons to where possible without, if you can do that without damaging the integrity, because I think independence is also valued in the commons world. It's definitely a principle, one of the principles, the eight principles in the co-op. I think it's eight principles in the that cooperatives follow. The other thing I would say, you know, as Ostrom said, is there are no panaceas. The commons isn't a complete solution either. I don't seek like a total commons world, but I would like to see a heterodox sort of world where the commons can thrive and grow and serve. So yeah, I don't know if that answers your question, Jeffrey, but that's a crack at it.
I think it speaks to this idea that there's no guarantee, that there's not an inherent promise, and you can put up this structure that it's going to promise that things are going to happen. It always falls back on us. And I think for me, I think of that in very democratic terms, that we create our institutions, we create our communities. There's not something that's going to make an institution eternally democratic. We always have to be aware.
Yeah. And it's a ongoing, continual process. On the one side, creating islands of sanity are like really important. And that I'm borrowing that from somewhere. That's not mine. And there are those islands of sanity already in the world where commons thrive. One example is in the Emilia-Romagna region of Italy. Over 30% of the economy is cooperative. That's amazing. That's incredible. In Quebec, it's like 13% focused mainly around Montreal. And there are big banks there that are credit unions, and they're major financial institutions. So there's also the Mondragon co-op in Spain that's been around, and it employs 80,000 or so people, and it's a ecosystem of co-ops or sort of governed by an umbrella. I think building these kinds of world on a local and regional or even bioregional level make a lot of sense. That seems where they've been most successful. I also think that this is more possible in countries with smaller populations. And I think there is this relationship between country size and how vibrant the democracy is and civil society is. So for instance, in Finland, there's tons of cooperatives there, Northern Europe in general as well. So I also think that if we were going to suffer some sort of collapse on a global basis, that the commons will be the reboot. And you know, we'll probably see what has happened in history in the past, is that if you are in an era between empires, that city states become dominant and then networks of city states build up. And often these city states are more democratic than empires are, right? And are self-governing and are places where where civilization is reborn. You couldn't have had the Italian Renaissance without Italian city-states. So these go together. Those small, intimate groups that rule themselves and must find their way together can be incredible petri dishes or crucibles of innovation. And that way, I'm really optimistic.
You're speaking to the virtues of the commons. What are some, I hate to bring common, but really, what are some common downsides or pitfalls that happen with the commons?
Yeah, I mean, the pitfall is that they convert somehow, and that they, because they don't have often the protection of the state or legal or regulatory legitimacy, they get destroyed, and they can be easily destroyed. They're vulnerable. So the government can just say, well, you're not allowed to manage this land in common anymore. There are no rules in the new system for communal ownership. So you have to divide up the land now. And so people divide up the land, and then it becomes a market system. This is like a common occurrence in developing countries, so-called developing countries. In a way, it's when they lose their commons, they lose their way of life, their culture. Like it's much more than the resource that's at risk. It's their identity, all of that. So that's maybe the biggest risk. And the other thing for individuals, if you're not used to a commons way of doing things and existing, if you don't have those democratic habits of mind, norms, and skills, it's not going to work. You won't like it, and you'll want a kind of more private property approach to managing a resource. So you need people who are culturally conditioned and educated and developed into humans who can operate in that environment. And it's so unlike a market mentality, right? So different ways of understanding relationships and understanding time and space. Yeah, that's just another pitfall. If you've grown up in it, of course, you don't have that problem.
For those of us who have not grown up in commons for the most part, but are wanting to, in the most practical terms possible, make some steps into living like a commoner, what are some practical advice you have for listeners?
What is it that you need in your life? And find other people who need it too, and then create something together that meets that need, and start now, period. Right? And what could happen, what we've seen happen after people have taken this initial step, is they go on to create these kind of neighborhood microeconomies with a collection of enterprises or commons that serve residents' needs. So get started now, because you can go on this whole new trajectory together with your neighbors into a new way of being that is in some ways more challenging, but ultimately more rewarding and better at meeting your needs, because you're in control with your neighbors. Yeah.
Neil, thank you so much for coming on the show and challenging our more state or market oriented minds. I wish you luck in creating more sharing cities.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you, Jeffrey. This was really fun. Only drawback is it was a short conversation, but I hope I get to talk to you again.
Thank you for listening to Damn the Absolute. I hope you found our conversation worthwhile. We would love it if you could leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether that is Stitcher, iTunes, CastBox, or one of the many other options available to you. It goes a long way in helping us to build a community committed to fruitful ideas. See you next time.